Every once in a while, I get a text that I'm supposed to preach on, and I wonder if I can really preach on it. The one from the Gospel of John felt that way to me at first. I think it's mostly because I'm not that crazy about the word glory. And I certainly wouldn't choose to use three different versions of it 6 times in 7 sentences in the climactic moment of any story that I was writing. Glory, glorify, glorify, glorify thy, glorify thou, glorify thee. It's just like, what is it? Majesty, splendor, glory, they seem like names for dishwashing liquids to me. They seem like words that you'd find maybe in travel brochures, 30 years old in some rest area that you pick up, and they're overexposed pictures of fake families with fake smiles by swimming pools. Brochures that have statements like, enjoy the majesty of the Rocky Mountains while basking in the glory of our pool. And maybe that is just an old word, and maybe it used to be a great word, but it feels like an empty word to me. It feels hollow somehow. And I don't know, but it's a word that makes me a little suspicious, I guess. Glory. Like, what kind of God cares so much about his own glory or her own glory? Maybe Zeus, or maybe Aphrodite. Maybe some god with long blonde hair, or some god with muscles, some god that demands constant homage. It seems like the kind of god that would care so much about his glory is the kind of god that would get really angry if he felt slighted. Like he might overhear someone say that he's not really that good looking, or he's not that smart, and then he'd make it rain for 40 days. Or he'd make the wind blow in the same direction for 40 years, so sailors had to placate him with sacrifices. It seems like that's the kind of God that cares so much about his own glory. Or maybe like Snow White's evil stepmother, or the queen, or whoever it is in Snow White. The one who goes to the mirror every day to make sure that it's still certain that she's the fairest of them all. I mean, I can kind of understand the anxiety that would lead to that. But could you trust a God like that? A God who is motivated by that? Look what happens to Snow White when she threatens the queen. The queen thinks she needs to die. Could a God like that really help us and care for us and love us? A God who's obsessed with being worshipped? A God that's obsessed with his own glory, his beauty, his muscles, his hair? So that text from John has glory all over it. Practically every word. Jesus is praying to be glorified. Glorify thee, glorify me. It's a prayer for glory. And I just felt like it was a little bit hard for me to get into that. Like, just shut the book, throw it out the window. I don't like Zeus. But then I had to remind myself that glory in the Gospel of John isn't at all what we think of when we think of glory. In fact, it's so different that it might as well be a different word. God's glory is so different than what we think of his glory, and we should remind ourselves of it every day. John says that we've seen God's glory in the Word become flesh. That's really kind of a crazy thing to say. In fact, it's the opposite of anything that you'd expect to hear someone say about God's glory. It goes in the opposite direction. The glory isn't in the transformation of mortal flesh into divine majesty. The glory is in the majesty becoming flesh. It's in the big thing getting little. The big divine omniscience, omnipresence, omnipotence getting human, getting limited, flesh, mortal. The thing that's out there and far away and above it all, getting the same as, getting close. The thing that's dry and ephemeral and clean and majestic, becoming flesh. Flesh. That's blood and bones and veins and skin. That's a tongue and teeth. That's really wild. And that's the glory of God in the Gospel of John. We've seen God's glory in the Word become flesh. And even stranger, When Jesus is praying here to God to glorify me, he means to raise him up on the cross, to lift him up to be crucified. That's glory in John's gospel, the cross. That is really a different direction than what we usually think of as glory. The crucifixion was a long, drawn-out process of public humiliation where a person is systematically deprived of all their honor and power. Obviously, the glory that Jesus is talking about here isn't the kind of glory of the champion hockey team hero. There's something in this glory about losing. Obviously, this glory isn't the same sort of glory that the queen in Snow White's after, when she's checking the mirror and making sure she's the fairest all the time. This kind of glory is more like hurling a huge boulder at that mirror and breaking it to pieces. This isn't Zeus all mad because someone didn't admire his muscles enough. This is God giving up all the muscle. This is the glory of God. It doesn't shine. It bleeds. How we usually think of glory, even how it's defined in the dictionary, is so much about being distinct, being distinctly beautiful or distinctly smart or amazing. It's about being separated out from the ordinary herd of people by some outstanding quality. It's about breaking away from the crowd. But God's glory goes in the opposite direction of that. The glory that Jesus prays for is that they may be one, as I and the Father are one. They are in each other, and he prays that we might be in him and he in us. It's all so intimate sounding, so together. It's all about union. It's not about being separated out. The glory is in the uniting. It's not the champion winner taking his place on the highest tier. It's the Father with the Son. It's God with us. The glory is in the uniting. I think we're kind of weird beings, because I think we want the glory, the our world sort of glory, the you're the greatest sort of glory. We try to get that because we want love somewhere. We want everyone to love us. We want the great big love union. But our methods, our systems for getting glory, our whole idea of glory works in the wrong direction if that's what we want. Our glory system works according to merit. You get the glory by being smarter or wiser or cuter or nicer or having better politics or being faster or more righteous or a better Buddhist or a better Christian or stronger or healthier or more ethical or more environmentally aware. Just somehow better than some people, somehow. The glory goes to the one who distinguishes himself. The glory goes to the winner. So we're anxious about that, and we check the queen's magic mirror to exhaustion. Subtly, maybe sometimes, maybe even unconsciously. It may be something that's in our genes. It may be survival of the fittest, but on some days we're there every other minute, looking in the mirror. Mirror, mirror on the wall, how am I doing? Am I out ahead? Am I getting a little behind? How's my glory in relation to everyone else's glory? I don't know if we like that, but we seem pretty attached to it. We seem to be confined by our system of glory. I don't think that we really, really believe all that much that we're saved by grace, that we're loved and accepted into the bosom of God, and that we're completed and healed by grace. I think we act pretty much like the time, like we're convinced that we're saved and loved and made all right by the glory that we merit. I think that we might have a deep and pretty big problem with grace. We're so immersed in our glory system that grace strikes us as a little bit offensive. And what's so offensive about grace, I wonder? The glory of God, which is not the kind of glory that we're used to at all. Why would that be so offensive to us? I think the story in the Bible, the story of the fall, the stories in the gospel, it all kind of seems to say that it's offensive to us because it implies that we really, really can't do it by ourselves. Grace implies need. And I don't think that we like being needy. It's scary. And we don't trust that there's really anything or anyone or any way to provide for it, for all that need. Needy to us implies bad and inadequate and weak. We do want relationship, and we do want love, and we want it so bad, but we just can't stand our own need. We feel so much safer having our glory system in place. We'd rather have that than to just be out there needing God and needing each other. So we make up this place to stand, like we can stand by ourselves. We believe that we're autonomous selves, moving ourselves through the world by our own devices, by our own merit, by our goodness, or our talent, or our power. We look at ourselves and we look at the world as if we're made up, as if it were all made up of unrelated, autonomous beings and things and events, like things were separate and independent, not one at all. Not in one another, not in creation, not in God, but separate. Of course, that's a lie. Autonomy is really complete fiction. At our core, we're very needy and very related beings. You can't move through the world autonomously. If you breathe, someone else feels it on their cheek. If you drop something, it drops on someone's head. And most of the time, you have no idea how your moving affects the world, and you have no control. It's not something we have a choice about. We are totally connected, and we need all around all the time, every minute of our lives. Without things outside of yourself that are holding you up right now, sustaining you, you would vaporize. You'd die. You wouldn't exist. Your life is absolutely dependent on gravity and food and water. And I believe it's absolutely dependent on God. But it seems like we can't really live consciously aware of that every moment. And so we make up this place to stand like we're autonomous. In the Gospel of John, that place, that made-up stance, is what John calls the world. And he really warns us against it. It's not because he says the world is dirty or bad or immoral or human. It's that it makes that place to stand, that it makes that lie. What was wrought in and out of and for a relationship attempts to live outside of it, lives in the world of merit, system, glory, and doesn't live by the grace of God. It's like I think that we really fail as lovers. We want it. We want communion and love and union. But somehow, almost all the time, our way of getting glory ends up being really alienating and severating and excommunicating, not love. Having to win or be better than gets us judging and drawing lines and not liking what's weak and what loses in ourselves and in other people. It's like we believe somewhere deeply that the needy don't really get the love. And so if you want the love, you better hide your need really well. And you better learn somehow to win at the glory game. We're actually not that much and not that often fools for love. We're not going to humiliate ourselves by needing love. And the craziest thing is that God doesn't act like we do at all. God is so much a fool for love, so thoroughly a fool for love, chooses need, chooses to need us. God's the fool that goes up the tree after the cat, chases, follows, goes to humiliating, dangerous, bloody lengths in pursuit of us, in pursuit of love, dies on the cross, loses, becomes the anti-champion for oneness, for relationship, all for the sake of union and for love. God stretches out all around our game, our glory game, breaks it to pieces and reduces it to ashes. And that's the glory of God. God's glory is totally for us. God's glory undoes the alienation and the separation that our glory system churns out. God's glory releases us to communion, releases us to genuine love for one another. And may we live there. Amen.